Came back that night and had dinner with my wife over at the Park Avenue Pub. My wife since passed away. And I said to Maxine that night, I'm going to sell my businesses. And she said, why? I could spend the rest of my life tilting at this windmill, but the forces of evil do not want to revolutionize the system. One guy in the room says to me, Ben, you'll never sell those businesses, Bruce, as one business. 11 months and a day later, I had sold all my businesses and I had sold them four different ways. The reason it was frustrating to me was because nobody wanted the pieces all to fit together. About 6 years ago, a colleague introduced me to a book called Reinventing Organizations.
You're listening to the Real Business Connections Network.
Real Business Connections Network.
Powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. Subscribe now and check us out at realbusinessconnections.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, once again to Rochester Business Connections on the Real Business Connections Network. I'm your host, Ben Albert. I am here today with a new friend, Bruce Peters. Bruce, we were just talking. I always say, how you doing today? But literally, I had to stop the conversation to click record because this is going to be just conversational and fun. You've got big visions, and I'm excited to be with you.
Well, I'm excited to be here. And as I shared with you, I had a chance to look at what you're doing, and I love what you're doing for the benefit of our community generally, but also for the business community. So it's a pleasure to have a chance to continue the conversation that we started a couple of weeks ago.
The big question that could fill up this whole podcast, because I mean, 30 plus years as an executive, a lawyer, an entrepreneur, an educator, now one of your main focuses, if not your main focus, is Beyond Teal. And your vision's pretty darn huge. So of all the things you've accomplished, why Beyond Teal?
Yeah, so when I go back, and I practiced law here for 30 years, and I was privileged in the very, very early stages of my career to make partner in a litigation law firm. But I was the only lawyer who had a general practice, and I gained an expertise in actually mortgage banking and real estate in its inceptions. And by total happenstance, I happened to be the attorney for the Bank of Caledonia in the early 70s. And you didn't even know that Caledonia had a bank, did you?
I haven't heard of it. Haven't heard of it. The listener
So it's the Bank of Caledonia. Well, back in those days, for a bank, for a national bank to come into a new territory, they had to acquire a bank in that area. And then Chase Manhattan Bank bought that bank, Bank of Caledonia. I was the attorney for the Bank of Caledonia. The young president who was going to come up for Chase Manhattan Bank was on the other side of the transaction with me. He enjoyed my company and working with me. And he came to me after the transaction was closed. And he said, you know, we'd love to continue working with you, but we can't work with your law firm because your law firm's a litigation firm. And we need broader expertise in the work to represent Chase Manhattan Bank. And I said, well, what expertise do you need? And he said, well, we need litigation, commercial litigation in particular. We need people who are expert in banking and banking work, commercial banking work. We need, obviously, real estate expertise. And obviously, Bruce, you have that expertise. And 2 weeks later, I came back to him, the U.S. attorney in Rochester at the time, and I and the best commercial banking lawyer in Rochester formed our own law firm. And 60 days later, we were the attorneys for the Chase Manhattan Bank in upstate New York.
Not bad.
6 months later, David Rockefeller came to town to announce that.
Yes.
And had a reception for us. And I was a young, wet behind the ears attorney. And that firm ended up doing mortgage banking work. And we did a whole bunch of things. Ultimately, we were, Phillips Lytle came over here and bought us. We had more business than we could handle. We could not grow our firm fast enough to support the business we had coming in the door. We were the attorneys for First Federal Savings and Loan in those days. And there was intermediation was in place for the S&Ls. And so they were taking all the failed S&Ls and merging them into First Federal. We were the attorneys for First Federal. So we merged with Phillips Lytle. Phillips Lytle, you probably know that firm. They're a wonderful firm. But you already know in talking with me, I was way too entrepreneurial to be a partner in a 160-person law firm. So sure. I stayed on for 2 years as kind of the co-managing partner for the transition, but with the idea that once the transition was intact, that I would leave. And that's what happened. I ended up going and starting my own firm and doing my own thing. In the 90s, I had designed a totally paperless process mortgage closing system. I had five offices across the state of New York. Offices all the way from Westchester to Lockport. And 4 out of every 10 residential mortgage closings that occurred in those markets in those years went through my office.
Wow.
And basically, we had kind of a counter strategy. Almost every bank in the state of New York was a client of ours, but we were not number one for anybody. So in those days, Ben, you couldn't be the first for Chase and the first for Citibank. They saw each other as competitors. And in those days, you couldn't be the first for Dean Witter and the first for Merrill Lynch, but you could be 2, 3, 4, or 5 for everybody.
Mm.
And that was my strategic business plan. I did all of that work. I love doing it. I love designing the system. And I got called down to McLean, Virginia by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the regulatory agencies, control of the currency, Federal Reserve, all the high level executives. They wanted to see my closing system. And I sat in a room in McLean, Virginia, with some of the best oak paneling and stuffed chairs you've ever seen in your life, and illustrated and showed them my closing system. And I heard for almost three and a half hours why nobody in those regulatory agencies would adopt my system. Came back that night and had dinner with my wife over at the Park Avenue Pub. My wife since passed away, over at the Park Avenue Pub. And I said to Maxine that night, I'm going to sell my businesses. And she said, why?
Why?
You love this thing. It's real. You build it all yourself. You build it from scratch. You build it from nothing. And I said, I just realized that I'm kind of like the man from La Mancha here. I could spend the rest of my life tilting at this windmill, but the forces of evil do not want to revolutionize the system. The complexity in the system allows everybody to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Money that's not necessary. And it's going to cost me too much of my life to change a system that people don't care to have reformed. The bulk of now, you as a home buyer, you know the system sucks, but you only do that a couple times in your lifetime. So unless you're a real estate professional, you're not in it all the time. So you're not going to join Bruce Peters' campaign to revolutionize the world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Ignorance is bliss in that regard.
Yeah, the system is, still sucks to this day, but. And so I said to Maxine, I said, this is going to sound egotistical, revolutionizing, making the closing a little bit easier for Ben Alberts of the world is not going to make a difference in anybody's life to speak of.
Sure.
And I said, I don't know how much time God's going to grant me to have left, but this is not worthy of whatever time I have left. And I decided to sell. That night, and my wife, God bless her, she lived through versions of me that, you know, anybody who has entrepreneurial instincts needs unconditional love from their spouse. Otherwise, you're in deep mucky do. And she said, Bruce, whatever you want, you know, do whatever you want. And so I did. About 2 weeks later, I hadn't decided exactly what I was going to do. But 2 weeks later, Ben, a client of mine walked in. He was a former Kodak executive, had just taken early out from Kodak. He walked into my office and he said, Bruce, I said, what are you going to do? I'm selling my house, you know, downsizing, selling my house, buying another house. I'm doing this. What are you going to do with your time? You're taking early out. You're a young guy. He says, well, I'm going to be a facilitator in a CEO peer group organization called TAC Worldwide. I said, what's that? And he told me a little bit about it. I said, well, it's interesting you walk in today because I've been thinking about selling my business. Could that peer group help me sell my business? Mm-hmm. And he says, I don't know, because I've never done this before, but I think so. The short version of the story, and I will shorten it up, is I joined a CEO peer group in early 2000. And I was the most annoying peer group member that God ever invented.
Why is that?
Well, because I came in and I said, look, if I'm going to pay $10,000 or $12,000 a year, whatever it was back then, I'm going to make sure I get my money's worth. And so I came into the first meeting. Now, I'm a lawyer, remember, and I was a managing partner at a big law firm. So I walk into the room and everybody said, why in the hell doesn't Peters want to be a lawyer anymore? Why doesn't he want to do that? Because everybody's got lawyers up on a pedestal, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, are you having a change of life? Is your marriage in trouble? Are you sick? I mean, I hear all of this stuff over and over and over again. People are asking me these questions. And I said, thank you very much. What else? I tell him, I just want to do it. Okay. So on and on and on, I hear all these dumb things that other people are telling me that I should be doing with my life. One guy in the room says to me, Ben, you'll never sell those businesses, Bruce, as one business. I asked him, why do you say that? And he said a couple of things. I didn't register with me, but the fact that he said that, I scheduled coffee or breakfast with him a couple of weeks later. And there's much more detail to the story, but basically 11 months and a day later, I had sold all my businesses and I had sold them four different ways. I sold my title company to a management buyout team of young people and were working in my title company, mm-hmm. management buyout. I sold my law firm to three different law firms. I sold my closing system to a bank in Providence, Rhode Island. And I sold my marketing consulting company in the mortgage banking space to a consulting company in Boston, Massachusetts. Handed over the keys, and I was free. Now, I might have gotten there without the CEO peer group or that guy's question. But the reason it was frustrating to me was because nobody wanted the pieces all to fit together.
Sure.
I had them put all together. He just said, wait a minute, you can't sell what nobody wants. You can't sell what you're trying to get away from. Do you know what I mean? So how smart was that, right? I might have gotten there, but I got there faster because of him. So, Bruce, what are you going to do next?
Yeah.
And I had no clue. Now, in my coaching practice, I never coach anybody to jump off the cliff and figure your way down, but that's how I am.
recommend it. It's just how I'm wired.
Yeah. And if you start out that way, and you may be like that, if I had to wait on tables to support my family, I would do that. That's just not... So that kind of gives you freedom. An old friend of mine said, if you cover the downside, the top side will take care of itself. So you don't have to have a detailed plan for how you're going to do it, but you better have a way to have, if everything goes to hell in a handbasket, what's your escape hatch look like? And have some idea of that. And so, because I've been around for a long time, I've got versions of that. So what am I going to do next? Well, I really liked that peer group thing, and it had helped me be successful in what I, so I said, maybe as an interim, I will go into training and I'll become a version of what my client became. And so I went into training for an organization which is now called Vistage, but was Tech Worldwide back in those days. Mm-hmm. And I go fly out to San Diego where the training is, and I walk into a room, and there's 30 other people in the room. And they were there for a week of training, all there to become technically, they called them chairs in those days. And I quickly learned in the course of the first day there was nobody in the room in training to be a tech chair who had ever built a business. Zero.
Wow.
A lot of executives, a lot of smart people, a lot of academic people, a lot of psychologists, consultants of one type or another. But nobody had ever built a business. No, everybody had ever been what would be called an entrepreneur. Nobody there ever made payroll with a credit card. The second thing, there was nobody in the room who had ever been a member of a peer group.
Really?
Yeah. Now, why do I tell you this? Well, if you think about it, two ingredients made it a lot easier for me to be successful and as a chair of tech groups is because I had built a business, it doesn't enable me to have more answers. It allows me to ask better questions. Because the CEO group members don't hire you as a consultant in that role. They hire you as a facilitator, a guide, or a guy like guide better than coach, but do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that I had made every business mistake a human being could make enabled me to find, and so I had my radar was good. So when a client's going off the wheels, I said, wait a minute, let's stop there for a minute and then use that background and that experience. Never projecting me onto them, but utilizing my background and experience to help them uncover and discover their answer. And the second part of it was half of the people who go through the training, because they never sat in the chair of anybody in the room, they think the groups are about them. It's not about them. The answers come from in the room. They do not come from the front of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And even the better questions when a group gets better. So I came back to Rochester and I built two CEO groups, peer groups, faster than anybody had done in the history of the company. And I get a call from the CEO of Tech Worldwide and he said, how the hell did you do that in upstate New York and Rochester? Because this is like the backwater of the universe. And I told him and he said, would you fly out to San Diego and spend some time with our board and our senior management team and tell them what you did in Rochester. They flew me out. I was supposed to stay for 3 days. I ended up staying for 7 days over a long weekend and went back. We went up to LA to meet some of their senior executives. And they had an idea about how to grow Vistage. And Ben, this is the highlight of my whole career. And you didn't ask this question, and I'm just going on. Stop me wherever you want to stop me, by the way.
I feel like this is a legacy story, so I'm trying to interject as little as possible.
And, okay, it's up to you.
And I mean, build the storyline as we go.
Right.
Please continue.
So I'm in the room, and they have a supply chain or a timeline, a value proposition timeline for tech worldwide. And they have a spot on the line and they say, Bruce, we have this idea about how to grow tech. And this is the highlight of my career. They told me what the idea was. And then they asked me my opinion. And I told them exact words, it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
Well,
Well, six or seven people in the room gave me my teenage daughter would give me, Dan, if you're so smart, what would you do? They gave me that. And I told them what I did in Rochester, and they hired me. They hired me to go around the country and train Vistage tech chairs in those days on the process and methodology that I used in Rochester. And so I had to give up one group here because I couldn't keep two groups and spend 3 weeks running around the country for them. And I would parachute into every city in the country, and I would do three things. I would create some kind of a strategic alliance with the Chamber of Commerce, the business journals, MBA programs, anybody who wanted to play in the CEO space, and create an alliance for them and help them build content that would help them increase and provide value to their membership. I would find people like me who could be mentors or coaches or chairs of CEO peer groups. And then I trained them on the methodology that I had used in partnership with the local partners that I had used for the building of CEO peer groups. And I did that for almost 6 years. And traveled all over the country, in fact, all over the world. I formed a group in Singapore. I formed a group in Birmingham, England. And my wife would travel with me. And then my wife passed away quite suddenly. And honestly, Ben, I don't want to travel like that anymore. And so I came back to Rochester, and I continued to do a version of that here in Rochester. In my work at Vistage or at Tech, and they changed the name to Vistage, so I left them. Michael Milken ended up buying Vistage. So the combination of Maxine's passing and me not wanting to travel and Michael Milken buying Vistage. You know who Michael Milken is?
Not sure.
So he was the junk bond king way back when Drexel Burnham was creating all these junk bonds, and he ended up going to jail because he played the market and that really? Sort of thing. Then he came out and he still had a lot of money and rehabilitated himself. He had cancer, and he created the Milken Institute, which is actually located in Santa Monica. But I didn't want to work for him. I had a couple of doses of him up front, and he hired some of the brightest, smartest people I've ever seen in my life. But you don't want to turn your back on anybody he hired. And so I stopped that. So I came back to Rochester, and I created, I had a CEO group that I continued to lead. And then I had a couple mentors in this space that I had worked with at Tech. And one of them is a guy by the name of Lee Thayer. And Lee Thayer had created the leadership curriculum at both Annapolis and West Point and was kind of unknown, but he was Stephen Covey was coached by Lee Thayer, to give you an example. You know who Stephen Covey is, right?
Absolutely. Seven Habits.
Right. So Warren Bennis was a client of Lee's. So I hit it off with Lee, and Lee and I designed way back in the early 2000s, about 2005 and 2006, a facilitated leadership class that I just taught the 1,000th plus version this morning, that I continue to teach. Lee has long since passed away. And companies and clients that I use send all of their seasoned leaders who need a refresher and new leaders that are new to the leadership role in one way. And I can talk about that, but I continue to teach a version of that. About 6 years ago, let me back up one thing. I have three or four clients here that I have started with their CEOs being in my CEO groups that continue to work with me to this day. And I can name a few. I don't like to promote me through them. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But a couple of them are some of Rochester's biggest success stories. And hardly anybody knows that I actually work with them. And I kind of like that because it enables me to work behind the scenes and under the radar and kind of do the things I like to do. So, That said, I started working with Lee there. Lee and I did this class, and I have great stories about Lee, and that's a whole other thing. But about 6 years ago, a colleague introduced me to a book called Reinventing Organizations. Are you familiar with it?
No. Sounds like a fantastic read by the title.
Right. And so Reinventing Organizations, the author is a guy by the name of Frederick Laloux. Mm-hmm. And Frederick Laloux was a McKinsey consultant, got so enamored with the ideas that he wanted to put into a book, he left McKinsey to start his own book. And so he self-published this book called Reinventing Organizations. The book coined the use of the expression of the concept of teal for organizations in the book. So there were 18 to 20 companies that were highlighted in the book. Some of them you will know. Patagonia was prominent in the book. Zappos in its earlier iterations was prominent in the book. Birdsorg, which is the world's fastest growing home healthcare nursing organization in Netherlands, is in the book. The biggest cement company in the world out of Brazil is in the book. So all kinds of different kinds. The fundamental principles in the book were these companies had, were organizing principles for these companies were three things. One was called evolutionary purpose. So it's purpose beyond just a profit motive. Mm-hmm. The companies have that. Certainly Patagonia would be a great example, right? Wholeness, where they're talking about unlocking the potential of everyone who works inside and outside of the organization. So it's about aligning your individual potential with the evolutionary purpose of the organization. And then the third element is the thing called that they called self-management. I get herky-jerky when you use the word management about working with people because I didn't want anybody to manage me. So I was always taught you manage processes, but you lead or influence people. And so for me, I changed the lingo to match up with my own personal beliefs. Mm-hmm. Lee Thayer happened to agree with me, which is one of the reasons I love hanging out with Lee. And Lee would jump at you. And when you said that you're going to manage somebody else, Lee would say, are you going to continue to be stupid like that? Or you're actually going to learn something? So that's Lee. Introduced me to the book. You don't know me, but when I read a book and the book speaks to me, that book spoke to me because I was already teaching all that stuff or non-teaching all that stuff. And I had no framework for it. I was just doing what I was doing it kind of intuitively. Even the building of the Vistage groups or tech groups, I never codified any of it. I was just doing it. And so I read the book, and the book had a couple of things that we were doing, that Lee and I were doing together, was foundational, was exactly the same things that were highlighted in the book. Self-leadership is one of those things. And so I decide to call Frederick Laloux. When I read a book that speaks to me, I try to contact the author. Sometimes all it is just to tell them that their book spoke to me and thank them for the work. In this case, I got a hold of Frederick on the phone when he was living in Belgium. And I said to him, the name of my company at the time was CEO HQ. And I said to him, I'm going to change the name of my organization because of the concepts that he's articulating. I'm going to change it to Beyond Teal. You never thought I would get to the point, did you? So I said to Frederick, I don't want to violate any IP. You coined the phrase and used the phrase in your book, but I'd like to change the name of my company. If you object, I'll think about something else. But I wondered if that would be okay with you. And he said to me the most refreshing thing I've ever heard from an author of a business book. He said, Bruce, do whatever you want. I am more interested in creating a movement than I am in owning any IP for me. Whoa. So our conversation continued for a little bit. I said, do you ever get to the States? He said, well, I just came back here, back to Belgium. He said, I said, are you coming back to the States? He says, yes, I'm coming there in July. Where are you going to be? He says, Ithaca. What are you going to do in Ithaca? I said, are you going to Cornell to teach? No, I'm going to Ithaca to live at the eco village of Ithaca. Why are you going there? Well, the backstory is he and his wife, she had written another book, a very spiritual book. They were both rock stars in Europe. They were like Michael Jordan in Europe. They couldn't have coffee in the cafe or without people coming up and wanting their autograph and bothering them. They really moved here for privacy and to have their kids have a relatively normal life.
And you're going to break his, you're going to break their cover.
Well, not now, because everybody knows now.
No, but back at the time.
Yeah. At that time, they were coming for a simple life.
Yeah.
And he, because he had self-published, he sold a million copies of this book. So think about, I mean, so he had more money than he ever thought he dreamed he was going to have. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in the conversation, he tells me he's coming. I said, well, that's great. And then in the conversation, he introduced, he says, you know, my best friend's from Rochester. Well, it turns out his best friend was from Brockport. He no longer lived there, but his parents still live there. And I go to Chautauqua every summer. The parents had a cottage two blocks away from me in Chautauqua.
Small world.
However, synchronicity works as synchronicity works. There's no coincidence in the universe. His best friend lived three blocks away from my son in Bethesda, Maryland, and my three grandkids there. And I go down there for a variety of reasons every 6 weeks. I go down, I meet his friend, have breakfast with him. We have a conversation, and his friend was doing consulting in the not-for-profit space, a really bright, smart guy. They were best friends because they were at INSEAD. Do you know what INSEAD is in Paris? It's kind of like the MBA program. It's like Harvard of Europe.
I think I'm 0-3. That's why we've got a note taker with us taking notes so I can do some research.
Okay. So INSEAD is their MBA program. The brightest and smartest of all over Europe are all gone to INSEAD.
Wow.
And who wouldn't want to go to Paris for dates or MBA, right? So so I have a conversation with him. About 3 weeks later, I come back and I'm respecting, you know, Frederick's now moved down there. And I don't contact him because of just what you and I are describing. He wants privacy. I am not going to be the person to try to invade his privacy at all. But he calls me on the phone. Bruce. Frederick. You know, first I have Frederick who, right? And but now it's only one Frederick. It's not King Frederick, it's Frederick. And he said, Eric says I should meet with you. Are you willing to meet? So I drive down there, we have dinner. It's a delightful dinner. And we talk about life and the world and all those sorts of things. How's he settling in? You know, all that kind of stuff. I come back on the car ride on the way back. He calls me on the phone. He says, Bruce, he says, I didn't think about this. He said, I'm going to be doing a 5-day workshop over in London, Ontario with the best anti-poverty program in all of Canada. Would you be willing to join me? Well, I got to redo my schedule, but the answer is yes. And so I go over as his guest, along with somebody from MIT who's an expert in Theory U. Are you familiar with Theory U? No, that's okay. I'm
0-4.
No, Theory U is the Presencing Institute from MIT.
Okay.
So it's the methodology there. It's great stuff, by the way. It really is good stuff. And so so I go along. He and I drive over. We stop at Optimax as a client of mine here. I invite the two founder CEOs to have lunch with Frederick and I. They get enamored with him. Frederick and I do some consulting together, ultimately, at Optimax. And, but I go over 5 days and I'm just a guest. I'm just in the room. I walk into the room and there's almost 200 white haired old ladies in the room, Frederick and me. Do you know who runs the best anti-poverty program in all of Canada? You don't. The Sisters of St. Joseph's.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable. I had no idea. So this was a 3 to 5 day workshop on all of the sisters from all over Canada, all gathering to talk about what they do and how they do it and to get better at their stuff. So that's how I got introduced to Frederick. The teal version was where teal comes from, Ben, is in the field of developmental psychology. Way back in the late 40s and early 50s, a guy by the name of a psychologist by the name of Claire Grave realized that adults go through similar stages of development like kids do, children do. So children psychology, you don't talk to a two-year-old the way you do. You have children, by the way?
I don't. My girlfriend does have two.
Okay. So what are their ages?
18 and 16.
Okay, so there's teenagers. You may be able to talk to them or not, but you don't talk to a 2 or 4 year old or an 8 year old the way you talk to a 12 or a 16 year old.
Not at all.
So those are developmental stages, and there's 6 or 7 of those stages with child psychology. Well, it turns out that there's similar stages in adult psychology, developmental stages. They were all uncovered way back in the late 40s, early 50s. And they color coded those. So an early stage would be red, and then it was orange, then it was yellow, then it was blue, then it was teal, then it was turquoise. So the 5th or 6th, depending on your field of psychology, was labeled teal. Mm-hmm. Frederick took those concepts and brought them over and color coded businesses the same way. So a very hierarchical, very structured, do things and paint by the numbers kind of business would be a red, and then varying degrees on up to the 5th level is teal. The 6th level actually is turquoise. And I carry a heart around in my pocket everywhere I go. You can't, maybe you can see it, maybe not, for turquoise, because that's aspirational for me. So why I'm talking about beyond teal.
That's turquoise.
Is turquoise.
Now, I was hoping we'd get to that because that was a question of mine. What goes beyond?
Yeah, so it's even more important for me because I'm hardwired to be, you know, to me, being great is the enemy of getting better, right? And so, so I'm always trying to push the edge of the envelope. I've been hardwired like that forever. And that said, though, there's a spiritual thing for me. So my Hebrew name is Abraham. And Abraham, way back in Aramaic and parts of the Bible, Abraham was labeled as the man from beyond.
Okay.
And they meant it in two ways. If you remember, Abraham had to move because he had to move. God came to him and said, Abraham, you got to go to this new land. Okay. So Abraham was known as the man from beyond geographically, because he was from across the river, but he was also known as the man from beyond spiritually. Mm. And so for me, there is a spiritual connection to the word beyond and the concept of that and to my spiritual underpinnings. So I put the two things together, and that's beyond teal. So let me stop there. Any questions?
Well, nowadays, and we're going to skip the rapid fire round because I want to go straight into what you're working on now. And we had spoke about it when we first met, building out these leaders and training these leaders in urban communities.
Yes.
And the purpose and the vision behind all of that was very profound. So talk a little bit about that initiative.
Yeah. A little over 2 years ago, I was approached to get involved in a program in the city of Rochester. to be a coach for a program they called the Resource Partner Enhancement Program. And they had some money from the state, and the idea was to find the not-for-profits that are all trying to support businesses in the city and help those not-for-profits fund programs to help those not-for-profits help businesses in the city. And business, the kind of businesses that I would describe as neighborhood and or community businesses, not necessarily high-tech, scalable, what might be thought of scalable business, but the neighborhood businesses. And part of the idea of that was one of the problems we have in the city is the neighbor is in urban environments is the neighborhood. What's the community, how it's structured? We have them, but nobody's really figured out how to grow them. And all of the entrepreneurial programs, frankly, are designed, and I will call them white man programs. They're designed to exit the city for the entrepreneur. Most of the entrepreneurs that come out of that environment don't stay in the city. They come out and live next to me in Pittsburgh. Yeah. Now, there's exceptions to that, and I don't mean, but generally speaking, the programs that are trying to be sold into the community that are wealth building are not designed to be community building. And if you were a Portuguese immigrant in the 30s in Providence, Rhode Island, and you wanted to start a bakery, you would go to the elders in the Portuguese community and borrow the money from them. And then the first time your blueberry muffins weren't good, the whole damn community would descend on you about your blueberry muffins. So they became your advisors and as well as your funders.
Right.
So you had scaffolding in place that would help. And it doesn't matter whether that was an Italian community, a Jewish community. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, we don't have that in the city. We don't have that kind of scaffolding for people. And so I had the privilege of working with Tony Hsieh on the downtown project in Las Vegas. Tony Hsieh took $300 million of his own money and got his employees to go create a whole new community in old Las Vegas. So I had seen that and been a part of that in action. And I thought, my God, how powerful would that be if we could do that in Rochester?
Right.
So rather than coming in and being the smart ass guy from Pittsburgh, what I did is I came in and I did a big time listening campaign. I talked to a lot of people. And a lot of what I suspected is true. What I'm saying to you is a kind of a result of my own personal research around this as well. There are communities in place, but the communities are in silos and they're in places and they're not helping each other. It's not like the immigrant communities that I was describing to you.
Right.
They're isolated. You know, there's just a not like, I mean, all the Jewish immigrants lived in one area, you know what I mean? And they supported each other. And that's okay. So,
yeah.
So in conversation, I found two things I learned. One, that kind of community. The second thing is the talent level of the people that are staying in the communities is incredible. The talent is all over the place. I've never been more impressed with a group of people who care and are trying to make a difference. Why isn't it working? They're all stuck inside of these dumb freaking systems that we've designed. Everything that's designed to support the urban communities is designed to fail. They're all working from a point. There's an $80 million fund coming down from the state. The food fight over that money is all from a scarcity mentality, not from an abundance mentality. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People are chasing this money, and they're all in the food fight. So they don't see themselves as collaborating. They see themselves as competing with every one of these not-for-profits. It's like pulling teeth to get them to even talk to each other, except at the level of the interface with the people in the community. But what happens to the the paralegal and volunteer legal services is they overload her and she gets burned out. She puts her head down and she does either one of two things. Either she burns out or she leaves. And both of those leaves a hole and a gap in the community that she was serving because she's got all this residue knowledge. So what are you going to do?
Right.
If we don't build community, then all these other things we're doing are not going to work. So Bruce decides that I'm going to go out and I'm going to be as smart as I can about how do you build community. So I just finished taking three community building classes, all based on the many of them based on the book by Peter Block called Community. And it's about the art and science of creating belonging. You said it up front, connection. We are so disconnected. And even the things we do to connect each other disconnect us in other ways. So the whole thing, the whole management guru thing for 10 years was about your tribe. Hmm. Well, that's great to a point. It works until it doesn't. And if your tribe's not talking to the other tribes, then it gets more insular. The more successful the tribe is, it's a zero-sum game. We get more, but they don't.
You're working in the silos.
Yeah, you're back. All you're doing is reinforcing the silos. Philip Slater, way back in the early 70s, wrote a wonderful, wonderful book called The Pursuit of Loneliness. And he coined two concepts in this pursuit of loneliness. One, he said, the unbridled pursuit of freedom and independence at the expense of our interdependencies will be the undoing of democracy in America. The unbridled pursuit of freedom and independence at the expense of our interdependencies will be the undoing of democracy in America. Does that have any resonance with you?
It's difficult because we live in a capitalist economy, so it's almost encouraged that we undo.
Yes. Yes. You can make an argument, and I could... I had the conversation. So I have five grandkids. They're all teenagers, by the way. And so I thank goodness I'm blessed with a great relationship with them.
Yeah.
And so I say to them, capitalism is evil. What's their answer?
I wouldn't know. Evil?
I say capitalism is evil. Their answer is, socialism doesn't work.
Sure.
Those aren't the only two answers to how we can live and work and play together.
Oh, no, not at all. It's not black and white.
But that's how people think.
Yeah.
Within seconds, if you criticize capitalism, they will start telling you how all these other things don't work. We never have the conversation about if we wipe the slate clean and we're actually going to design a system that achieves the objectives we're trying to do, what would that system look like? We don't have that conversation. Capitalism or non-capitalism. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we get into this kind of polarized either or conversation. So, one of the things that I learned from the class, I just finished all these classes, by the way, so this is all fresh in my mind. There's a half a dozen things in that. And by the way, if you ever want to, you can read the book. You don't even need to read the book. You go to the back end of the book and you get the summary, and ChatGPT will give you a summary and you'll have the summary.
True.
And one of the things I learned from the community building is the methodology that he's articulating in the book is a way to begin to have the kind of dialogue I just described, where you begin to have dialogue about answers as opposed to grievances. And so the process of that is something I've actually created a mini dialogue group where we're beginning to try and take those principles. And you almost, and the first step is to suspend what you know.
Suspend judgment.
Suspend what you know. Can you? And then when I used to lead peer, when I was leading a lot of CEO groups, I would walk in the room as the facilitator, and my mantra to myself or my self-talk was, leave everything you know behind. Because they did not hire me for the answers. They hired me for questions.
Questions.
And so the learning came from in the room. It didn't come from me. The other thing I would do in the room, because you can't stop yourself, if you're in that room and an issue comes up, it's not like I don't have an answer. My answer pops into my head, right? So, oh, this is happening. Well, I have an answer to that. My self-talk is, oh, that's my answer.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what question I could ask that might change my mind. And I learned over time, after a while, that gets into my DNA. I go there automatically. In the early days, it was self-talk. And at that point, the questions that I'm asking are enhancing my learning, but they're also enhancing the learning of everybody else in the room at the same time. And I'm modeling the behavior of not being the knowing person, but being in the learning mode, not in the knowing mode. We need more of that, not less of that in our society.
Learning.
And so dialogue and community building principles are the kinds of things that allow you to begin to do that. So that's where I am right now. So I've got a small group of people that I'm trying to work on. I don't like to use the word training, but we are creating together mm-hmm. a guides concept to be able to bring this kind of community building and dialogue into the communities we're trying to serve. But ultimately, to give the community that's in place tools in their toolkit for building their community. Getting things out of the way that are not, you know, that are disconnecting, and finding more things that are connecting. And that's my work.
Beautiful. Bruce, how do we stay in touch, support you, get involved? Well, what should we do next?
Well, I would like to know more about your podcasting strategy, because I think podcasting is something I need to do. We need to do in that the communities we're talking about, and so and there are a couple people who agree with me who are in that community. So, as I shared with you early on, you know, I was doing podcasting before podcasting was a thing, so I know just enough to be dangerous about all of that. But I can see where it could be a really good tool in the community that we're trying to serve, and then. I candidly, Ben,
and
we've
Bruce.
Also got to find ways to monetize that, because if I can't find ways for them to monetize that, then we're in that zero sum game again. You know what I mean?
So this is a discussion for you and I. We can go deep offline, but before
yes,
we click stop, what can the listener do? That's been a fly on the wall for this conversation. What can they do to support you? BeyondTeal.com or what?
Yes, they can. Well, you can go to our website, BeyondTeal.com. And my basic day-to-day consulting practice includes mostly people who are in what I call their third act.
Hmm.
And so, inside of organizations, the 55-year-olds or the 50 and 55-year-olds that life is not, you know, is this all there is kind of that. And so it kind of answers the question, what happens when you get what you want? But also people outside of organizations where they're in that third act and they're looking for, what I call my work is about helping people to manage meaning, uncover and discover how do they make meaning and that stage of their life, this stage of their life, and as well as maximizing connection. We do have an epidemic of loneliness in our society. And so awful lot of my work, Ben, and you touched on it early, people are disconnected from who they are, from themselves. They're disconnected from each other, and they're disconnected from the community. And so the antidote to loneliness is actually connection. And so what I try to do is help people build those connections so that they can live that this third act of their life and make a contribution back for everybody. So the merger of getting those kinds of people together with a community building in the city is kind of the design, the theoretical design or strategic design of the way I'm thinking.
Let's keep doing the good work. We'll continue to connect. I am here to support you. And on behalf of everyone, thanks for coming on the show, Bruce. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. And as I said, I'd love to hear more about your experience of podcasting, and then maybe I have my own podcast where we bring you on.
That'd be fun. Yeah. Bruce, we'll talk soon. Thank you. Thanks for listening to Rochester Business Connections. Don't forget to share this, rate, and comment on your favorite platform. You can also email me, ben@valbertmarketing.com. Let's connect soon. Until then, keep thriving, everyone.